This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Get out can mean a lot of things. You might simply be telling someone to go outside and play like Mom used to tell us to do. Or you're telling someone more than that. Move out. You are old news. Or the job's over. Or out yourself. Live life openly, gaily, openly pagan, openly non-mainstream. Openly you. Or get out might simply mean no way. You're just joking me. Today I'm going to bring you a number of stories interpreting that phrase, get out, and we'll see what getting out means to different people. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today's show is called Get Out. It's a theme that we visited in 2008, but this week I'm bringing you a new mix on that old theme.
Let's go outside.
Get going. We're going to get going by going outside in installment number one. When Courtney Rush gets outside, she finds God. This is Courtney's story of God and the environment, her two greatest passions.
The bottom line is the times that I've been in outdoor situations and been experiencing the outdoors, I always feel the presence of God there. And being outdoors, I think, draws me nearer to God. And so then, since both living for God and being outdoors are my passions, it was so neat that the two of them were so strong when coupled together. And I've just learned a lot about my belief in God and how His creation is not separate from Him.
Courtney is an environmentalist. She studied natural resources and conservation biology in college, and when she finished her degree, she went to work for the Palouse Clearwater Environmental Institute. Court runs the volunteer program, and there couldn't be a better person to do the job. She's upbeat, energetic, passionate about her work, and able to talk to anyone with interest in their goals and abilities. Not a feigned interest, but a look you in the eye, slow down and pay attention because what you think matters kind of interest. And with that kind of interest, she can match anyone up with the right volunteer task. And if you're not sure that you want to volunteer, hang around Court for a while and you'll discover her enthusiasm has rubbed off on you too. As for her own personal interests, when she looked herself in the eye and paid attention, she saw that the environmental part of her was being met at work. But she wasn't seeing religious people contributing time and effort to environmental causes. So she decided to reach out to churches.
With my course of study in college, I was in restoration. I was in natural resources and conservation biology. And through being able to work at PCEI, it was almost like I got my network of people who were interested in that environmental sector. And most of our volunteers do not come from a faith-based mindset. Most of our volunteers come with environmental mindset first. That's why they're here. And I was noticing that not very many people of faith are in our community are reaching out for the environment. And I know they would want to if they knew about the opportunities, or at least if somebody told them, hey, have you ever thought about how important it is to be caring for our environment? And so with that, as I started thinking about that, then I set my goals for this year being to reach out to the church populations of the community and then also the elderly populations of the community, because both were groups that I wasn't seeing volunteer at PCEI. So with that, and with starting to have a goal of reaching out to the churches, that's when I started seeing the churches try to reach back and say, hey, we are interested in that, or that's a huge topic in the church right now. Come and tell us a little bit more about it.
Courtney may have hit on something big. Environmental conservation is a hot topic in Christian churches, she says.
It's actually almost a trendy hot topic in Christian faith right now.
Even so, not all Christians take the same stance as Courtney. The argument that she's heard is that it's God's will that global warming is happening. And if it weren't God's will, he could stop it and would stop it. If he can't stop it, he's not God. But Courtney doesn't buy it. Instead, it boils down to basics for her.
When Jesus is asked to sum up the Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, okay, basically, what are the rules that we have to follow? And he says, love God and love your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've really got to thinking about is, how do we love God?
And that is done by taking care of the earth.
I feel like in protecting the outdoors, not only am I serving God, but I'm also serving the people that I love. And that would include my friends, my future family, you know, anybody that is involved in this world. I think that we all have a part in caring for it and leaving it to be a better place than we received it as.
She says that taking care of God's gift is an expression of love.
God gave us this amazing creation. And even if, you know, even if he said, this is for you to have dominion over, do whatever you want with it. It would be our choice to love him by caring for that gift. And I recognize that other people see it a different way, and I don't see how you could see it any other way.
And on this basis, Courtney has moved forward on her plans to reach out to faith-based groups, not just Christians, but anyone who considers themselves spiritual, to encourage their participation in environmental activities. She first got invited to give a keynote talk at the Faith and Environment Network in Spokane.
It was really flattering because they wrote to PCEI and said, we'd need a keynote speaker. We're doing Faith and Environment Network. We're talking about why it's important to care for the environment as people of faith. All sorts of different kinds of faith coming together to this conference. Is there anyone that could be our keynote speaker? So it got forwarded to me, and I was like thinking about, how do I audition for this? And do I need to turn in a resume? And so I wrote an email back and said, this is who I am, and I'd be really interested in it. And they wrote back and said, yeah, we know who you are. That's why we contacted PCEI. And of course, we want you to do it. So it was like, they had already known who I was, and it was through an AmeriCorps connection. So an AmeriCorps member that had heard me just give a talk on volunteerism in McCall, her mom's on the network. And so I guess she had mentioned to her mom that I would be a good speaker for the event. So
cool.
Yeah, it was totally cool. And then I spoke twice at Christian Life Center, which is CLC. It's a Christian church that is trying to get heavily involved with caring for the environment. And they were doing like a 6-week sermon series on the importance of taking care of our environment.
Courtney's presentation at the CLC was different from a keynote, more of a question and answer session about why the group should care about the environment. Or really, why Courtney cares, her personal story, coupled with an appeal to come out and help with the local stream cleanup on Earth Day. She may have found her calling, something she was born to do.
It's something that I've been involved in for a long time. So since basically I was in high school, I've been taking trips with, say, my youth group. So I've been in the outdoors experiencing God with other people. Then my job through college was as a river guide in Colorado for a Christian rafting company, where I could either choose to or choose not to engage in conversation about God in the outdoors. And then, but I had the freedom to talk about with my customers about whatever I wanted. And then most recently in college, I started a group on campus, and it was called the Wilderness Crew. And it was an offshoot. I was involved with Campus Crusade for Christ. And so this was the Wilderness Off-Campus Crusade for Christ. And so I've been involved with getting other Christians and other people of faith into the outdoors to know it and to meet the outdoors, you know, and to see that it's worth protecting and that it's such a vital part of who we are. And so through all of that, I've always wanted to become more active in talking to people and encouraging people to become involved in caring for our environment.
Courtney has found a way to combine her passions, God, and the environment. Her message is an echo of her experience, which is get out and get God.
The music of the spheres, this is my Father.
Women's Voices, Women's Stories on Yin Radio. Today's theme is Get Out. Installment number 2 is about getting out for the first time. Out of the womb, that is. It's about birthing babies. Alice Swan has 2 children, Rex and Enzo. She shares the stories of their births with us in this next installment.
When I got pregnant with Rex, I wasn't planning to get pregnant right at that time, and it was right. I mean, I found out I was pregnant a week after I moved to Moscow from Minneapolis, and I was pretty freaked out by it. And I think that it took me a while to come to terms with, you know, being in Moscow and being pregnant, and so I didn't expend a lot of energy on sort of educating myself about birth because I just sort of assumed that everything would be fine. You know, I called my health insurance company and said, I'm pregnant and I don't know where to go. And they said, oh, go to this doctor. And so that's what I did. You know, I didn't, I didn't know anybody to ask, you know, and I didn't ask any questions. I just went. And then I took the short childbirth class that was offered at the hospital that didn't really teach me very much and just kind of assumed, like, you know, the doctor would say, oh, the baby's head down. And I'd say, great, that's the position he's supposed to be in. Well, I didn't know it was a he, but as it turned out, Rex was posterior. And the first time I ever heard anything about a baby being posterior potentially being a problem was after he was born.
Alice learned a lot about having babies and about what could go wrong, or at least what could deviate from that simple story of contractions, dilation, push, 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 and out comes baby.
So I have very long labors. I was in labor for 44 hours with Rex before I had a C-section.
Needless to say, Alice was pretty tired as that long, long labor went on. But she had been hoping to have a natural birth, so she held off on any interventions for a long, long time. For 44 hours, to be specific. And a lot happened in those 44 hours.
I was 2 weeks overdue. I started labor on my own the night before I was scheduled to be induced. My contractions were 30 minutes apart when they started, which I subsequently have learned is generally a bad sign that you're going to be in for a long, a long labor. But all night, things were progressing. They were getting stronger, closer together. We called the hospital, and we were almost to the point of, you know, lasting 5 minutes apart, lasting 1 minute for an hour or something like that. We were almost to that point, and then it stopped. So we had called our families, said we're going to the hospital, and then it just kind of stopped. So I had a doctor's appointment that morning, and I went in, and the doctor stripped my membranes and then said, go to the hospital at 5 today, because if things are progressing, you will need to go in, and if they aren't, we're going to induce. And I just didn't question it, and I went in, and things had, I mean, the contractions had started up again. So we went in, and the first thing that they wanted to do when I got there was break my water. And I just sort of said, okay, I guess that's what we do. But my son was posterior, and he got stuck that way because once you break the water, there's not much room for the baby to be able to turn. And so I never dilated past 5 centimeters. And I had Pitocin after, you know, after I don't know how many hours, but, you know, I have been at 5 centimeters for. Pitocin is the synthetic, it's like the drug that causes contractions that they give you to induce labor or to augment labor. And it's really awful because it causes really strong contractions that are really close together. And especially if you've been, you know, up for 2 nights as I had been when I got it already. It's just, it's really hard. The Pitocin then caused Rex to go into fetal distress. And so they stopped, and then they started it up again at a lower dose, and it's still, he still wasn't responding well to it, and I still wasn't dilating anymore. And so then I had surgery, and, you know, 10 minutes later, he was born.
It didn't go as simply and smoothly or as naturally as Alice had expected. Having the C-section had not been her plan.
It was really disappointing. It was emotionally difficult to sort of, you know, to see. There's some, like, in some way that I felt like I wasn't a real mother because I didn't actually, you know, give birth. And I know rationally that that's not at all true, that that's not what makes you a mother, but it was something that I really wanted to do. And I didn't, and I just felt like somehow, like my body had failed my baby.
Alice and her husband, Nick, did have support through this long birth. Their friend's mom was a labor and delivery nurse in the hospital, and she was experienced with many births. She wasn't on duty when they went in, but she came to the hospital to be with them.
Having this older woman with us who's been through birth so many times and knows how everything is supposed to go, was just so comforting.
Alice's first birth story, the support of the experienced woman and the long labor and the complications, led her to a different approach when she became pregnant again. She hired a doula very early in the process. A doula is a birth assistant, not a midwife, but an experienced woman with birth education and experience. She knows what to expect, what the options are, and how to provide physical relief to the mom, and to the dad, too. Sometimes, especially if he needs reminding of what his job is. The partner can get pretty lost, especially when mom is in pain. When Alice got pregnant the next time, she started reading. She wanted a VBAC, a vaginal birth after C-section. So she started planning.
So I spent all this time reading about birth. And one of the things that I learned was that if you have this, early labor that starts out very slowly and stalls out, like, often that can mean that your baby is in a bad position. And that if you give it time, that things can, and it can, you know, it could be that it would have taken 5 days, you know, from when I first started. But, if you give it time, things will work out. And the baby, he very well could have turned if I hadn't just gone to the hospital and had my water broken. So so I also, like, given that my labor had been so long, and I just felt like I needed, and that we had had this friend of ours there with us who is very helpful, but I sort of felt like I wanted to hire a doula who I was paying to be there for me, to be my advocate. And because it's a little bit different when we had this woman there who was our friend, who was a labor and delivery nurse, because I didn't feel like I could say to her, you know, this is the way that I want you to do it, which, and a big part of that was, I don't want you to offer me pain medication, you know, whereas if you're hiring a doula, you can say, I don't want you to offer me pain medication. If I decide that I want it, I will ask for it. And you can, I just feel like you can be a little bit more sort of assertive about the way that you want things to be, and that's their job, is to do what you want them to do.
Alice hired a doula, Stacy Pettit. Alice took a Bradley childbirth class. She saw a chiropractor and an acupuncturist to help the baby position himself well. She was careful to sit right. She was admittedly a bit obsessed with baby positioning.
I was having acupuncture to help position the baby in a good way. And he was not, he was head down, but he was kind of sideways when I started labor. So he wasn't anterior, but he also wasn't posterior. I woke up on a Friday morning in labor. It was actually my due date, which was really incredible since my first son was 2 weeks late. And my contractions were 2 to 5 minutes apart. And I thought, this is great. You know, and I was kind of aiming for like 18 hours, which is, you know, not short, but, you know.
Short compared to.
Right. And so I labored at home, and we called Stacy, I think, in the afternoon, and she came over, and we did a lot of walking around, and, the contractions were pretty intense. They were not ever regular, but still 2 to 5 minutes apart, and I should have realized, and Stacy was, you know, never sort of said anything about going to the hospital, because my contractions weren't regular, but I was just so stuck on, like, this one's going to be easier that at a certain, well, and then I started throwing up, which is, can be an indication that you're approaching, that you're in transition, you know, that the baby's going to come pretty soon. So anyway, at a certain point, late Friday night, I really wanted to go to the hospital because I was thinking that I was probably farther along than I was. And we went, and I was 3 centimeters dilated. So one of the rules at the hospital was that the doctor for VBACs is that the doctor has to be on site the entire time that you're there in labor. And so they called my doctor and he said, she's not in active labor yet, I'm not coming in. So the early labor is like up to 4 centimeters. 4 to 7 is active labor, and then transition is 7 to 10. And then so he said, she's not in active labor yet, I'm not coming in. So as often happens, once I got to the hospital, things kind of, the contractions slowed down, spaced out. And Stacy suggested that I might want to have something to eat because I hadn't really eaten all day. And the nurse told us that I couldn't have anything but ice chips. So the thinking on that is, if you, and this is a VBAC rule, not a general rule for everybody, but if you have to have a repeat cesarean, if you end up having to have an emergency cesarean and have a general anesthesia, then you're not supposed to have anything in your stomach, right? And I knew that that wasn't quite right, but I just, you know, when you're in labor, you're just not in a position to argue with people because you're concentrating so hard on what your body is doing, and it's not fun. And so, after the nurse left the room, Stacy sort of said, well, do you want me to go get you something to eat now? Because that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And then she also said, you know, if you weren't a VBAC, they would send you home right now. And she said, I think we should leave. And we did. And I'm not sure, I think that the idea would have crossed my mind if she hadn't been there, but I'm not sure that I would have actually done it.
But Alice did do it. They left the hospital. But it wasn't over yet.
So we left, and I was in labor for 2 more days. And we had, Stacy spent that first night with us at home, although we were all sort of trying to sleep. And then in the morning, it sort of became apparent that this was going to drag on for a while. And I had come to terms with the fact that the contractions were going to need to be regular before, even though they were painful and hard, they weren't regular yet. So it was Friday night when we had gone to the hospital the first time. And then on Sunday morning, things were still kind of, this whole time also, I had never gone more than 15 minutes without having a contraction.
Even when things had slowed down, it was still 15 minutes.
Yes.
Ooh, you're tired, mama.
Yeah. And I was able to sleep some on Friday night, but Saturday night was really hard. I didn't sleep. And so Sunday morning, I decided that I wanted to get checked again, partly because Saturday night had been much harder. The contractions were, like, I'd say probably 7 to 10 minutes apart, but they were really strong. I was trying to sleep in my rocking chair in between contractions, but I had to stand up during the contractions. Oh. It was the only way that I could get through them. Sunday morning, I decided I wanted to get checked again, so we called the doctor, and then we called Stacy to ask her to come and go to the doctor's office with us. And so he met us at the office and checked me, and I was still 3 centimeters dilated. At that point, I sort of felt like we might as well just go into surgery now, because this is never going to happen. I was so frustrated and demoralized that things weren't progressing, especially because it was so hard. And Stacy just sort of said very calmly to the doctor, well, what do you think our best option is right now? And he said, you know, I think your best option is just to wait and do nothing. And so with the two of them sort of convincing me that that was the best thing to do, I went home again, and we sent Stacy home again because he still was not, you know, it didn't seem like anything was really going on. And I got sort of mad about all this and thought, you know, like, because I wanted to do something. And so I was trying to do, well, and the other thing is the doctor said, I don't think that the baby is quite in the right position yet. I don't feel the head pressing down really well against your cervix. So he's probably just a little sideways and needs to turn a little more. And then once that happens, you know, things will happen. So I went home and I started walking sideways up and down the stairs, which is a good thing to do to kind of jiggle things around that can help the baby turn around. Lunges are another good thing to do for that. Anyways, so this whole time also our older son had been with a babysitter. And so we also had called her and had her bring him home. So I was walking sideways up and down the stairs, and then suddenly something changed. And I was like, I knew then that the baby had turned a little bit, that I was now in active labor, because the contractions, they did get regular and they got so much stronger. And this was not very long after we had come home from the doctor's office, and I didn't want to, like, because this had dragged out so long, I didn't want to, like, call Stacy back right away. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't say anything to my husband either. He was outside playing with our son. But after a while, I just couldn't do it myself anymore. And so I went out to tell him that things seemed to be moving along, and I was really, you know, I was in need of support. And he sort of said he didn't believe me. He said, well, let's just give it another hour. And I was like, oh, okay. But then really, when he came inside and found me in the shower, like, swearing at everything, then he called Stacy back and the babysitter. but also, I mean, at this time, I was just exhausted. And so not that long after, I mean, it was sometime Sunday evening that I said, I want to go to the hospital and get an epidural because I'm just done. Well, and I mean, the other thing is that we had gone through this whole thing with Stacy where we had been walking all over. I had been in, you know, 18,000 different positions. I had gotten my, she had suggested that I get my breast pump out and pump because nipple stimulation is one of the only things that's, you know, only sort of natural ways of inducing labor that's actually scientifically proven to work. and it didn't help me at all. But so, I mean, we had tried everything. And Stacy was, you know, she said, you have given it your best shot. You don't need to feel bad at, I mean, you've been through so much. You've tried everything. You deserve to go get an epidural now if that's what you want. We called the doctor and said, we're going to the hospital. Alice wants an epidural. We went in and they checked me, and I was 4 centimeters dilated now, but I also was, I had been not fully effaced before, and I was. Then?
And that means position?
No, it's the thickness of your cervix. And the other thing is that the baby was farther down in my pelvis. So things had progressed. And then Stacy said, once we got there and they checked me and things had progressed, she said, do you want to try just laboring a little more without the epidural since, you know, things have progressed? That's a good sign. And I was feeling so much better then because I had been at 3 centimeters for 2 days. And so I did labor a little longer without the epidural. And then the doctor was at the hospital because I was in active labor. And a couple hours later, he checked me again and I was still 4 centimeters. And so at that point, I was like, he said, I think that we should now try augmenting with Pitocin. And I said, I am totally willing to do that. I am thrilled that we're going to do something to speed things along here, but I don't want to do that without getting an epidural first. So I did. And Barry, I think it was about 5 hours later that my son was born. So the whole beginning part of it took a very long time, but it was the... And then in the end, so I had an epidural, I had Pitocin, I had the vacuum extractor also. So it wasn't exactly the natural childbirth that I had envisioned.
For Alice, education and advocacy made the difference in her birth experiences. It didn't go as she hoped either time, but it went as it did, and she was prepared as she could be anyway, for the unknown. And she had Stacy to be her voice when she got tired, frustrated, or just plain passed out.
So even then, after I had the epidural and the Pitocin, I was kind of lying on the bed, dozing off. But, you know, Stacy was there for my husband because I wasn't in any condition to be talking to anybody. And I'm sure that Nick was nervous, you know. So it was nice to have somebody there for him. And she took pictures. You know, we have pictures of, you know, Enzo being born and of right after he was born. And one of the things that was worst about the most unpleasant things about the C-section was that the baby is born, and from the moment that they take you into the operating room until the baby is born is a very short time. And then Nick left with Rex. And I was just there in the operating room it takes like 45 minutes or an hour to stitch you up after a C-section. And there I was by myself, having just had a baby, and he was gone. And so one of the things that I felt very strongly with about having a doula the second time around was, even if I had a repeat cesarean, I really wanted somebody to be there with me in the operating room after the baby was born, just to hold my hand.
Among other things, Stacy was there to hold Alice's hand. It wasn't easy to get them out into the world, but Alice Swan is glad to have 2 healthy, happy, growing boys. We'll be right back. And the next two installments on this Yin Radio show called Get Out are about coming out, announcing your identity as a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender person. For the University of Idaho's Talk About It project, LGBT students, staff, faculty, and community folks shared their coming out stories. This is Rebecca Rod's story, her experience of coming out while attending a Lutheran college in the 1970s.
My freshman year at the Lutheran college I attended in my hometown, I met a girl named Linda, a friend of a friend of my friend that I really didn't like. She was sweet and bubbly, and her shoulder-length red hair bounced around when she walked. I was more moody and reserved, given to writing serious poetry and smoking cigarettes. But when she found out that we were both English majors, she somehow pulled me into a friendship with her strange, sunny disposition. Then I began to notice, when I was with her, I felt a kind of energy in the air, like sparks and the force of magnets working overtime. In fact, whenever we'd take a walk together, we'd constantly bump against each other, and just this accidental contact between us seemed to leave a radiating space on my body wherever we touched. This was new to me. Even though I'd had the usual physical contact with the high school boys I dated, this was different, more like exquisite. Well, it turned out to be mutual, and soon we were begun, so to speak. It was pretty wonderful for a few months. Then it turned out there was a worm in the apple. She was a Baptist, and the guilt of our loving started to eat away at her, and I was Lutheran after all, so pretty soon she had me praying with her that we would not do this anymore and just be friends. But it never worked, so she broke our relationship off after a few short months. My heart was broken and my spirit was crushed, and I became a cynic about love. I was angry and confused at God for coming between me and my beloved. After all, if God was love, how could loving be a sin? And if you are a religious or spiritual person at all, finding yourself in this situation, you realize that you have a devil of a choice to make: God or love. In my mind, this is where the really crushing spiritual damage is done. For people who have grown up with God in their lives, who love God and have been told over and over again that God loves them, coming to this desperate point stunts the blossoming of a spiritual life just like that. So I just stopped going to church and packed the pain of all of it away from me. Yet practically daily, I prayed to the God I didn't believe in anymore to please just make me be normal. I dated guys for a while again, hoping something might take, I guess. Nothing did. And so I began my stumbling journey of hide and seek with love. Only it was more like seek and hide, in the sense that I was secretly seeking love, wanting it so badly, I knew if I found it, I'd have to keep it hidden. Then in my senior year of college, I met another Linda and fell off the wagon and in love again. The critical thing about this second relationship was that it made me begin to think that there just might be a pattern forming here in my life, like I could be, gulp, a lesbian. Linda and I actually talked about our relationship sometimes in rather nebulous terms, but we pretty much decided that we weren't really lesbians, that we were just in love with each other. After all, we both had had more relationships with guys than with girls. And so comforted, we went on happily for some time. But as my feelings for her grew, I felt at a loss for words to express the depth of them, being limited by the vaguely defined relationship we had. I can remember the day when I tried best I knew how. I just told her I felt like I wanted to marry her, even though I knew I wasn't entitled to use that label. I remember feeling so relieved when she didn't turn away in horror or laugh at me. Eventually, we moved to the liberal hotbed of Iowa City, where we found a whole bunch of women like us. That was pretty amazing. And this is where the label that was so scary and to be avoided at all costs became a label of love and belonging and healing. We were lesbians now in the company of other women like us. Finding and being in community with people who accept you is definitely a salve for the pain of separation and alienation that many of us feel. Things went along pretty well for us for a while, until Linda's mother figured us out. She came barreling down to Iowa City in her car to pay us a visit, during which she screamed at us the whole time, blamed me for corrupting her daughter, and said, "If I had a gun, I'd shoot you both." And then she left. The violence of that encounter was pretty stunning. Not long after that, we broke up again. This devastated me so badly that I couldn't hide it, and that's when I started my coming out process with my family, which is another story.
Installment number 4. Liz Brandt, law faculty and associate dean at the University of Idaho, shares her story of coming out. It is her story, but it's about her son. Liz has been an activist for years, supporting gay rights, women's rights, full inclusion, and human rights for all. She thought she couldn't be closer to the issue of gay rights than she was, especially after the Idaho amendment to ban same-sex marriage, and lots of other marriage rights, snuck up and passed. But then her son came out as gay, and her perspective changed.
Last fall, my son Christian told me and his father that he was gay. At the time, he was in Denmark in the first part of a year-long exchange for his junior year in high school. He sent us an email. In the email, he said he had known he was gay for some time, and he meant to tell us before he left for Denmark, but he just never found the right moment. This email announcement really affected me. I'd never thought about whether Christian was gay. In retrospect, there were many clues. His absolute refusal to go to dances at school and total lack of interest in girls, even as a high school freshman and sophomore, were a couple of them. When he told me, however, I had the sense of total understanding. Things about Christian just clicked into place. Both his father and I thought, of course, how could we have not known this detail about him? My feelings about Christian's email were mixed up and emotional. On the one hand, I'm very grateful that Christian was able and comfortable enough with himself to understand his orientation, and grateful that he will not have to go through some long period of doubt, secrecy, or self-loathing. Yet he's my baby, and he was across the ocean. I couldn't look in his eyes and assure myself that his core identity was still strong and intact. I now have looked in his eyes and hugged him and know that he's okay. However, I still worry about him. I know being a gay man will not always be easy and that he will encounter hate and misunderstanding. I know that my brilliant, beautiful son will not always be valued for his skills and talents, but will sometimes be dismissed because of who he is. Christian's hesitation to tell his father and me that he is gay has caused me to reflect on how much courage coming out requires. Some who read this may not know that my husband and I have been committed activists in the cause of LGBT civil rights for many years. We have marched in parades, volunteered to be plaintiffs in lawsuits, and have written and spoken in support of LGBT rights. Our extended families are also very supportive. Christian's aunt and her partner have been together longer than his father and I have been married. I know that some of Christian's hesitation to talk to us was just parent-kid stuff. It's hard to talk about intimate matters that have sexual overtones with your parents. But I also know that even in our supportive family, Christian worried that somehow his relationship with us would change because he came out. My son Christian is gay. But what you really need to know is that he is a brilliant young man who cares about others, wants to study cultural anthropology. He plays the cello, the ukulele and the piano, and he loves theater. He speaks Spanish and Danish. I'm very proud of him, and I love him with all my heart.
Reading the story evoked emotions that were closer to the surface than Liz had realized. She spent some time after the reading to talk to me about those emotions.
Well, it was just so hard to be so far away when he told me. So reading it just makes me think about how worried I was that I couldn't talk to him. And, you know, I couldn't talk to him about the sex thing. I was really worried that he would be, you know, he was over in Denmark and that he would be experimenting and that he might not be safe. And, you know, so I, you know, kids experiment with sex, but I just think it's a lot more dangerous for gay kids than it is for straight kids when they experiment with sex. And I worried that just that he maybe was a little lost about it, and that's why he hadn't told us. It breaks my heart to think that he's going to encounter barriers, and I worry a lot about it. He's kind of grown up in this wonderful, safe community. The high school here is very supportive of kids, and he has, I think, never really encountered any discrimination. Other people have paved the way in his family, and so it's just sort of was like, oh, yeah, okay, to his grandparents and his cousins and stuff. And his friends here were pretty accepting. They knew long before I did. I guess he's been out to them since he was in junior high. So, you know, they didn't care. And my daughter just couldn't, his twin sister just couldn't believe we didn't know. But I, you know, you don't think about your kid in that way. And so I just didn't.
I asked her, as a mother, what do you worry about?
I really worry about him leaving this safe place where he's been loved and honored for who he is. And I worry maybe he doesn't have the tools to deal with, you know, things that might happen to him. And, you know, how will he be able to handle them? And, you know, he's one of those kids who just doesn't get that everybody wouldn't just love you right off the face of the map, you know, that it would just be the automatic thing that you would do. And so I worry, you know, I just think you worry about your kids and you want their way to be smooth.
She probably knows as a mom and, of course, as an activist that the barriers are out there.
You do. You know, I, for all of my lefty leanings, I'm a really pretty conventional person. And my husband and I, we have a pretty conventional life that we love. And I want Christian to have that too. And I guess that's the other thing that makes me really emotional, because I think the barriers on gay marriage and stuff, I wonder, I want him to have a life partner who is as wonderful as my husband. We've been married for more than 20 years and it's, you know, I can't imagine life without him. And I want that for my son. And I think that, you know, it's hard enough to have long-term, stable, intimate relationships when you're when you're just to have the mainstream ones and everything's set up to support who you are. You know, to sustain those kinds of long-term relationships over all the bumps and pushes and shoves that are going to come when you're not in the mainstream, that's even harder. And so I really worry about that. And I want him to enjoy being a father. And I wonder how will that be able to happen for him? And will he be able to find a way to make it happen, to be a parent and a father? That's been really an important part of our life. And I think it's something he envisions for himself too, that family thing. I don't think, you know, I don't see anything about him that is a, you know, who knows? He's just starting college. Who knows where I'll end up? But I want him to be able to have those things that he wants. And, you know, so I worry a lot. I don't want him to have to be a plaintiff in lawsuits or be a poster child for things. You know, I have a sister who is a paraplegic, and She spent her whole life being the first paraplegic at her college and being the first this and the first that and being the one who's always telling them that you can't get a wheelchair into the restroom and the curb cut is broken down and she can't cross the street. And, you know, I admire her, but I wouldn't ask for that for people. You know, and I think that's kind of, in some ways, Christian's not going to be the first. There are generations of people who have had to have a lot more courage and have broken through. But still, I think, you know, he's still, you know, of an age where, you know, we were so unaccepting of LGBT lifestyles and people that, you know, he's still going to be paving the way. We still don't. You know, there isn't a normal there, and I guess I find that to be kind of a scary thing.
Being in the mainstream, being normal, is comfortable.
It is comfortable. I'm there, and I recognize how comfortable it is. You know, there's a real privilege of being inside that normal envelope, and, you know, I guess I honor that privilege all the time. I know it's there. I enjoy it. I enjoy white privilege and straight privilege, and, you know, it. And I guess it's maybe selfish, but I want my son to have that too, and he's not going to. And that's a really scary thing for me, you know. So I read this statement I wrote, and just kind of brings to the fore all those fears that you have buried as a parent.
Liz Brandt's son plays the cello, the ukulele, and the piano. He loves the theater and studies cultural anthropology. He's a brilliant and caring man. He has a mother who loves him and worries about him as mothers will and do and should. Liz's worries are compounded by her knowledge and experience as an advocate of human rights, so she knows how hard it can be for someone who's not in the mainstream, like her son, Christian, who is gay.
This next brief musical interlude is performed by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Well, there's one more interpretation of that Get Out theme of today's show that we haven't yet covered. But this next song and the last segment of our show will take care of it for us. It's about leaving. It's about getting the heck out. The song is Leaving You, and it's by Sharakasha. I leave you with it.
Thank you.
Catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive our electronic newsletter or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Drop us a line at yinradio at vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.